the evening, and it's at the Botanical Gardens. And that's also...
Isn't that 27th?
Didn't I say the 27th? I said the 26th. No, 27. Seven. Okay. And the other thing is that there are mailing list cards at the door. I know all of you who've been here before have heard me say this 100 times, but they're these little yellow cards, and if you'd like to be on the mailing list and hear about future readings at Duff's and other readings around town, we'll put you on our mailing list and you will receive information. The first poet who's going to read this evening is David Kluel, and he's a contributing editor to the Chatter Review. And he's teaching at Webster College right now. He's an artist in residence. And his two books of poems are Room to Breathe and The Blood Knows to Keep Moving. And I want to welcome David Kluel.
Thinking about getting together some poems to read as a group tonight, looking over a manuscript, I found three quotations that I've used in that manuscript that must mean something to me. So somewhere around a pivot of these three very different quotations will probably hinge some of the poems this evening. The first is from a master entrepreneur, Napoleon Hill, whose 1938 volume, Think and Grow Rich, has gone through many, many, many printings. And he advises that one of the problems that is in the world today is due to the fact of the normal human acceptance of the word impossible. Thinking from Napoleon Hill's wonderful thing to make a lot of money, I think of a contemporary poet, dead now, Frank Stanford, who said, memory is a shotgun kicking near the heart. And the third poet, probably my folk hero of all, street thief, and wunderkind Francois Villon, who said, we cry good news, so much it comes. First poem, Losing My Voice. The memory of holding a shell tight to the ear's lips and hearing the sounds inside where the whole ocean fit. Lap of wave, hiss of drying sand. Funny, the sea, never at storm tide, yap of undertow dragging gravel, dredging up bottom, always the water clearer than your memory of it, the sun keeping its eye out, scouring the beaches white and safe. Now the memory of the shell itself, a dry bone in your hand, the animal long gone, overgrown or dead. In your mind, pick it up again. Listen for the swell of ocean there, drowning the darker side. Think, if you can, how pretty this shell, this sea, this haunted house of air. In the morning, one morning, it's gone without word. In its place, I inherit a collection of wheezes nesting in my larynx. I look in the mirror at what I want to say and see strange eggs pushing up my throat and breaking in my mouth. In the street, everyone wants me to come again. I find ways to suggest to them I'm doing all I can. The woman in the grocery makes me rasp honey half a dozen times until she's certain it's just small talk. Soon I try force to get it back. I bang my chest until my hands turn into conciliatory gestures. The remaining words go deeper, humming among themselves. In my head, I deftly step through sentences, through nuance and inflection. But what comes out is the sound wind makes through a paper bag blown out. Why do they choose now to get me going? Long distance calls, people at my door with clipboards wondering what I think. I whisper to them all, I've lost it, that I can't say what's to blame. I've thought about that too, taking well-intended cures, now honeyed lungs, now salted tonsils. When I swallow, a teabag rises and falls in my throat. in a field, a woman digging potatoes. The wind blows something in her ears before dark. She stands up straight, eyes into the trees. It's nothing, at least nothing she can say. She bends back to her work, filling baskets with potatoes. Yanked from the soil and sleep they know, they stay quiet in their skins, in their vegetable rage, giving away nothing of the whiteness that burns inside. The pulp, the heart, the thing that sustains them. What the woman can't hear, all there is to say. And at about that same tragic moment in the summer, after losing a voice and all the pleasures and sorrows that goes with that, I was cheered by a package from a friend of mine who knew that I liked to work about some of the quirkier things in my poems, and he sent me a box filled with journals of scientific earthworm farming. He thought this would cheer me. He thought surely there would be poems here. He thought surely if there were not poems here, there would be fun and at least some profit here. And I began to read the earthworm journals and think about all the wonderful things that worms are used for, not just for fishing, but farming, and all the possible money to be made. And I tried to picture myself as such an earthworm farmer. This probably falls into the range of what I was talking about as the impossible. And the poem, Getting Down to Worms, begins with a quote from one of these scientific journals that said, "The pursuit of the earthworm business could lead to wealth, or at least to a comfortable living." For the worms, a comfortable living, being treated with peat and your awkward kid gloves. You're the one up at all hours, looking for a good rain and straining to see in the glow of your own strange lights. Your naive excitement with the first successful catch, the worm nonchalant. And then, when you finally collect enough to matter, keeping them cool in a shady country, following diagrams for making a worm bed, then reading that the bed must be kept clean of uneaten food in order for the worm to be delighted. This point, at least, is something you understand. For the worms, a lounge chair, magazines with cutaway profiles of exotic soils. You leave a few tall glasses of iced tea in the garden. You watch them all for a while, these well-adjusted, healthy worms. Finally, you crawl through the dark towards your house, your tired eyes deflated, sinking deep into your head. You hear the sound like a snapping of fingers, a beckoning, but it's only 1,000 earthworms cracking the lounge chair back, reclining. Your own inclination to go running, but you don't. Instead, you keep on walking into your house, your legs on fire with being tired, checking your own sheets for traces of food, lying down, tunneling underneath to the foot of your dark bed. You try to empathize, but you can't. For the worms, a kind of smile, the best you can muster, like a slice of lemon, sour, embedded in your face, balanced neat on your set jaw. Determined, you feign indifference, but the rich dirt hugging your nails is a measure how far you have come. And you sit thinking through the rest of that night, thinking through the worms. Towns, different kinds of towns, are things that seem to come up in my poems again and again. This is not so much a specific town, but that kind of town, a small town, the town where a lot of people who are born there hang on and stay there and live out their life there, no matter what the odds are for that. I'd like to read the first two parts of this poem. It's a longer poem. The first part, called The Dogs, is in the voice of such a person is still a child. And the second part, called The Game, is about a softball game in this town. And this is the kind of town that doesn't have different teams. It's not big enough to support different teams. There's one team, the town team. The poem is called Heroes. This is the dogs. In my town, people said dogs barked their heads off every summer. I used to stare at every dog and wait. I'd drown the heat in a bottle of pop, watching Mazzetti pumping gas. Old men came by to hash over the weather, and he'd hide underneath a Plymouth and curse. Once, when he was making easy change, I asked if he'd ever seen a dog bark its head off. He said it just seemed that way sometimes, like they could if they wanted to. That day the old men thought the sky looked like rain. They hoped so we could use it. I laid my bottle in with 100 other empties and decided in this town dogs couldn't, even if they wanted. After that, I stayed up nights, saw the way lights went quiet, one by one, then out in all the houses. Trains hummed past midnight to another day. Did the mayor sleep with bigger ambitions? Did the bag boy from the grocery dream a day his thin arms would lift love? Up in bed, my hands invented shadows on the wall. With practice, they got good. Dark shapes of filling stations, trees lining darker streets. When I twisted my body a certain way, I could make the hospital where I was born. I made my own face in one of its windows, looking out, just barely alive. I made a parade go past. I put someone in the back of a sedan, excited and waving. From that window, nose to the glass in a nurse's arms, it seemed like he could have kept on going, could have been waving goodbye. The game. Friday nights, the town eats early. Lights flood the field and bleachers fill with people cheering themselves on. Any team from out of town is good enough to lose. The taste of sweat at lips curl is enough. Reminds them something's on the line. Mazzetti reaches for the fences, uniform drenched in this good life. Junkman Turner knows throwing strikes all night is worth 500 cans clanking empty before noon. They have been dreaming all winter of this, the home run trot, the perfect game. The players chatter the air into frenzy while the crowd yells its heart out where they can see it. They play the game over in the tavern past midnight until the last song spins out of the jukebox, snapped up in the din as they throw themselves out to where car doors slam, keys turn toward home in their ignitions. All the way back, the radio is ecstatic with the news. He smiles, tugs at his shirt, the letters of the town heating his chest the way love used to. He breaks up in the driveway and strikes a match, a small bargain of light. He sees his wife's face, quiet as she leaves the car, moving without looking back into the house until he's lost her. His fingers burn and bring him back to the big game, another night he's come out on top of. He's learned the hero's words to say how it was nothing when he knows different, how it must be something to wind up in the dirt so many times and sliding ahead of any throw or daylight or thought of turning back, sliding into home through the dark, thinking safe in the middle of his life. I am fascinated with magic, stage magic, the kind of magic that people spend a lot of time figuring out how it's done. This kind of magic is less in fashion now, and instead we have Uri Geller kinds of magic, and there are spoonbenders all amongst us. This is a poem that harkens back to a time that the magician, who was a center of my world, takes center stage once again, and it's a poem called The Magician's Lunch. No one pays their way in anymore, unless it says that you'll read minds way back in the cheap seats, or find a purple comb in the bottom of a purse, or piece together names and birth dates dancing in the air. The cards I make fly, the fire in my hands, the dove born out of its own whiteness, not enough. Maybe levitate a body and they'll come up, slow, out of their reasonable drinks. So now I do days, half-empty auditoriums, rows of schoolchildren figuring how it's done. They just guess what they've been told, the wires, the plants, the hollow toppers, handkerchiefs with 5-inch hems. No one worries when the saw comes down and threatens the woman into two. I'd count the days in nickels all week until Orpheum Saturday morning. Newsreels marched us closer to war, but the tinny band never failed to show, sounding Boldini on stage. For an hour his arms would wing through the air, wrapping all of us in, and we applauded the way he summoned birds and fire, drew out all the color he knew. My eyes were crosshairs beating in on those hands where a ring on every finger caught the pale stage lights and threw back shades of amethyst, of emerald and ruby. He never said a word, I remember. The day I ran home, my mouth filled with the wildest stories yet. The woman floating above the stage, suspended, the whole audience breathing her breath. Out into the backyard and 90 degrees, my father locked out of his work shed, sitting on the steps and cutting new keys out of the hot afternoon. The buzz of flies and me seeing what's wrong, waving my arms in front of the door, calling out, believing in my best abracadabra. My mother at the kitchen window, calling me into lunch, winking at my father like, you know he's excited. And he, disappearing back into the sweat, the metal taking shape in his ringless hands, shaking his head like, the boy's gotta learn its keys and common sense what opens doors. This is a story, poem that tells a story basing off of something that presumably happened just a few years ago. And my poem is an address to the boy it happens to. And the poem is called Why the Bird Dropped You, Marlin. And the newspaper item revealed that two large black birds with 8-foot wingspans swooped into a backyard in Lawndale, Illinois, and took a 10-year-old boy for a 20-foot ride, his mother said yesterday. You're just finding out what you don't need to believe. 70 pounds, not enough yet in the world to realize what your screaming said. To your mother, waving her own arms like wings, wanting the world to slow down for a second. To the bird, scared in its prehistoric brain, just playing with you and the experts who would say, no North American bird like this. What could you know over the beating of wings, of bird heart and your own heart flapping out the rib cage, over softness of breast feathers tousling your hair? Your weight? Not too much for this bird, not the scream flying out your small mouth. Maybe the bird itself, feeling its own hugeness crowding the day, too suddenly unexpected, lifting you like another feather, but straining the limits broad daylight allows. At night, with no one watching, you could have gone farther. You and this great bird together, no longer a bundle of uneasy grace. Moving in and out of the dark all night until breakfast, and your mother calls you down, and you come from wherever you are. anything less conspicuous than a Midwest summer afternoon? From now on, you'll hear 1,000 answers to no question. When you talk with your friends and the reporters come flocking, stick to your 10 years, all the facts they want to know. Later, in color encyclopedias, you can look for names that fit: the jet black wings, the 12-inch head, the rings around the neck, and the claws that came down on your shoulders and had you, Marlin, had all of them going for a while. I am fond, too, of railroad tracks and old hotels, and have spent time in and around a lot of the old Grand Railroad hotels that have fallen on harder times, that are now more the transient hotels where people actually live and board. This is a poem in three parts called The Lodger. One, what comes back? The way his mirror catches sunlight today, says there was another time, and for a minute he's willing to take it on blind faith. He knows nothing ever comes back right. When he recalls the night clerk who brought up whiskey, 2 cigars in humidors, he can't see back through the blue smoke to the gap-toothed grin, the cracked skull when they found him on the stairs days later. He summons up the train that ran along the river, all the towns it made desperately possible. He wanted to be sure he'd mean for good. He still sees the brakeman's wave turning cruel in the years the train stopped running through. And then the woman in the sports car, blonde, top down, a good green wind up from the south, and he remembers how the nerves went soft, how the blood rushed a message to his head that for one day, at least, he could live forever. Sometimes in his sleep, he hears her gunning up Maine, and he could die. Today, his clock will lose a few more minutes, an act of love he's learned to count on. But when the sun drops down into the river, it's no falling star, no secret sign, no reason for saying anything but this. Just another day rolling over, spent. Next comes the moon, that dusty mirror. He has to laugh. He remembers some things right. How the moon rises through the dark, its pale faith a small wonder, bending home its parcel of light. Radio. Sunday nights the ancient Philco carries him away. Familiar stations disappear in the air, and he can pull in towns he's only heard of. Tonight, Susan, someone in Poughkeepsie, naming her best lovers. The whole city of Cheyenne sending out tunes to the Hammerhead, deep in his hall to Aberdeen. The mayor's up late in Sandusky, taking questions from people with dogs. Buoyed by the weather report in Tacoma, he rattles off the names of all the gas house gang, but the Pontiac goes to some kid 1,000 miles away, and that kid's only close. It's a night of strange connections, flying saucers, mutant strains of VD, the threat of war and celebrity birthdays, and now the gospel man who lives at the top of his lungs. For the hell of it, he joins the radio in prayer. He imagines someone plugging the soda machine and all the cans fall out like Christmas. Half-hearted cheers going up in the lobby as the movie burns through television snow. And just when he's getting to the really good part, the preacher turns into Mel Torme and, "Forget about the blood of the lamb. Would you like to swing on a star?" Rising and falling. Hours in the room next door, they've been banging the bed senseless. Each time he knocks on the wall, someone screams another promise, it won't be too much longer. Nights like this, he tries to picture every angle two bodies could hope for. Flesh slapping flesh until finally the tide in the blood goes out. In his bed, brushing against sleep, he imagines the whole hotel rising and falling in hot flashes. Knows anything can pass one time for compassion. Tonight, his room key could swell in the lock until it turns into the key to the city. The man crawling up and down the hall might be the mailman with years of letters come to beg forgiveness. If a toilet flushes upstairs, it's a bomb set off to free him. His coat is never far from his bed. And still, the room next door's on springs. He wonders if anyone will walk out alive. The last lights in his eyes give out, and in the dark, he listens to his own heart pounding the thin walls of his life. He could teach his heart a lesson on all the good it does, how it's better off wishing for something to snap, some thread of nerve, a leg, the bed caving in. This is the prayer, it can't be too much longer. The prayer he'd like to put his heart in. The prayer the next day answers wrong. I'd like to read what for me is a short poem, a poem called The Hard Rock Kid, who was four times crowned king of the hobos long before Britt, Iowa got to be the tourist center that it is. In the time of August, there's election of the new king and queen of the hobos. The Hard Rock Kid was on his way out to California, retiring from the active hobo participations, but stopped by in Britt to see a number of his friends. And about 24 hours before the festival in Britt began, the Hard Rock Kid died in a park on a Sunday afternoon, and the eulogy at his funeral was being delivered by the then current king of the hobos, Steam Train Maury, who said nothing could be more wonderful for a hobo than to cross over the Jordan while sleeping in a park. In a sketch, he'd fall right in with the lines of the tree he lies against, flicking off mosquitoes, naming each one for a town with a face he'd recognize. Some young softball kid lays into a fat one, sends it skyward. Hard rock follows until eyes close and night sounds hum his body home. Half a century, and he knows the trains are faster, days longer when the body slows. Still, small secrets get him by, like ways the blood knows to keep moving. Squeezes shut his eyes so tight, 100 headlights prick the black, and he picks one, imagines a rumbling familiar as breath. Times his jump, but doesn't jump. This time, Sunday, no reason to move. He's gone over and over his brain, every fold in the map of his country. He feels the red bandana in his pocket, balled up, clenched like a fist or a heart. Under the last moon, he remembers there are secrets he keeps to himself, that the lazy fly ball has finally fallen and gone home is one. Another poem about a person that I met only briefly, but a person who made an impression on me is a friend of mine worked with Beatty Brothers Traveling Truck Circus, which is the world's largest traveling truck circus, at least it was at that time, the kind that would really pack up and move from town to town. And we attended long after he had discontinued his association with the circus, but we went back when it was in a town near us. And I was introduced to some of the people he worked for in his brief couple of months stint. And we spent some time drinking with a man named Old Barney, who was the head of circus labor, who every year was going to be his last, and he'd said so since he'd run away and joined the circus about 30-some years before that. And this is a poem for Barney, and a poem that really was born out of something he said as we sat in an after-hours spot long after the circus was packed up. The poem is called Dancing Down the Circus, and it begins with some of Barney's words. It said, "Just wish one thing was different. Wish I'd married and had a daughter to treat real good. Would have called her Rose. Around this place so long he knows the snake woman's given name. Knows after 37 years it's done with mirrors. This way his face still shines on nights wheeling into dawn. Each town he rolls into, he's coming home. Sleeping days in the head trailer while the midway swells like a river in storm. Waking, rolling smokes with the lions. He's king of this jumble of canvas, poles, and wires. He knows every stress and gesture giving the circus shape. The freaks tell him secrets they keep from people who pay to be told. Each clown lets him in on a new way to grow older. Somewhere in the middle of all those years, he watched a tiny girl in red trickle down the midway, and he followed, calling her names he loved. All night he imagined a daughter whose name was a flower. While the townies danced the circus down for a handful of coins, he went to the last tent standing, kissed the girl he held tight as breath to his chest, and tossed her high, up past the tops of cages, past the silent high wire, until her tiny legs touched canvas and kicked through, and they both saw stars silvering the sky on the first real night of their lives. Tonight, wind whips the tent flags another color. A few drops of rain, and it's a different country, tearing down this last tent in a storm. He dries out in a neon after-hours corner where he tells his daughter's fortune to strangers. A few more drinks, and he glues his eyes to the door. Each time a woman whispers in, his heart quickens up his throat and goes out. Rose, a name that grows too big for the hollow in his chest. Rose, Rose, a woman, finally, perfectly formed on his lips." And the last place I'd like to bring you in this short tour of places is to a Dowsers convention. Dowsers have sentimentally always been my favorite people, operating on what we'll call the fringes of science for now. And I have seven slides from the Dowsers Convention. And the keynote speaker at the Dowsers Convention mentioned this fact, that although dowsing through the ages has been associated with the search for water with a forked stick, the so-called divining rod, the means and ends have expanded broadly in recent years. One. Maybe that explains this exhilarated matron wielding her husband's flannel pajamas and offering insomniacs cures for a dollar. In the noise, all that's heard is that her husband's never failed. Two. Then this man with one arm and a coat hanger that will pinpoint your war wounds for a loved one. You are unnerved when you hear he will use his own discretion. Three. In the back of the hall, the town's mayor growing smaller. Someone from the coast used a bottle of wine to find his oldest daughter last night at 2 a.m. Four. On days like this, crude maps are persuasive. Lots of arrows. You could be anywhere. Successful finds are blown up on an overhead projector. There's the mayor's daughter sitting pretty. Five. The keynote speaker drones on dryly. His voice cracks like parched earth. He is dealing in facts. He sweats, makes it clear the glass of water in his hand is only a beginning. 6. At dinner, the dowsers parade to the river. These are the old ones returning to the source. There is no doubt in their minds. Those sticks are bucking wishbones in their hands. 7. Here they are, up all night trading secrets. They fill the hall to overflow. They drive hard bargains with the skeptics that float in, making believers of themselves all over again. This poem, As Far as the Eye Can See, is a poem that's been in progress for about a year and a half that started innocently enough with a sonnet. The sonnet is long gone. It's expanded up to 15 parts. It's come back down to 3 parts. It stands right now in 5 parts. I'll omit 2 parts that are dreams. But what the poem has to do with, when I was young, it was a great euphemism to have lost my father. Wondering where I put him. I found another person later on who had also lost his father, and for a while we had a society, the Lost Father Society, and we used to go around looking for our fathers. It became quite an obsession, not just in humorous ways, and this poem tries to clear through some of that territory. It's a poem for Joe, and it begins with a quote from the poet Cesar Vallejo, who said, "I believed until now that all the things of the universe were inevitably fathers or sons in the backyard. On summer nights, my father would sit still, watching the sunset over the house give up to the beginning of the dark. When stars burned through, he thought of counting, but the numbers never came as fast as stars. He shook his fists, the fireflies winked. He'd walk over to the garden, thinking what could grow there, tomatoes, lettuce, beans, a way of saying he had plans, and he cursed the flowers for coming back another year. All that fall, doctors called it a miracle. Each day his brain shrugged off more cells and kept on humming. Each night he prowled the backyard, he made his stand against a house full of strangers, their mouths full of patience and love and other smaller treasons. He filled his pockets with notes to himself. Every smile's a loaded gun. He'd read them to moles he imagined in the hedges. He covered himself with leaves and sang Amazing Grace until his voice got dry and thin. When the leaves turned to snow, he declared his private war on the planet and hurled his body at the ground again and again and again. He knew what came next was the kitchen light, a beacon calling him a long way home. A face at the window hoping he'd come, praying his heart's low droning would steer him one more time through that dark kingdom of angels frozen in snow. The story of light. I remember staring through the telescope your father gave you when you begged him. He showed us how everything seemed closer, bigger than it was. On nights with no moon in them, we aimed at lighted windows, looking for constellations of girls we hadn't seen before. One night, overgrown with stars, he collapsed on the porch in the middle of his life and left our questions hanging dumb in the air. What are stars made of? How big are they really? We knew all about wishing, but we didn't know where to start. After the funeral, we learned names. Sirius, the dog star. Ursa the bear, Debbie Fuller the long-legged blonde. We drew charts and diagrams, made plans to see our way clear. We weren't old enough to know the story of light, how fast it can move and still be so long coming, how it comes at once from what's dead and what's alive. We still can't tell the difference between first light and last when it rummages through our sleep or sits down in the parlor or waits behind the curtains we draw in the bedroom until we finally come up out of women we love for air. Your father's eyes are flickering stars fixing themselves in your sky. Remember how light's measured in years you never would have dreamed. It's time to swear off wishing forever, time to curse them in their distance, in their shimmering aberrations, curse them for rising cold from your belly every night to name the two of you one in the blood. Curse the life they shed light on, curse the story of light. Better to see what they should have become. Make them stones you would sink straight down in water. Make them gristle in the soup. Make them dull coins covering the eyes, not stars burning their white apologies, not anything you've waited for, not ever. But coming out on the other side of this, as we go through a dream to get there, the final song called Song in Spite of the Smart Money begins with an epigraph from this man's own poem, that says, I hammer your laughter into your cradle. Joe, the next time you stay up late, drinking in the only place that's open, don't worry about your imaginary son tunneling his long way out of the future. Right now, he could be crawling through the day your own heart closes down for good. If he stops to rub a lucky stone, if he makes a wish, it's nothing you can hear, and you know better how everywhere sons keep trying not to give themselves away. Trust to your glass half full of bourbon, the constellation of loose change splayed on the bar's dark wood. Nights like this, the smart money's on stories whose endings we can live with. The lame cast off their crutches and collapse in the dirt. The princess has to settle for the village idiot. It's true we know every day more or less what's coming, but we keep singing our cities to sleep with songs about how anything could happen. In this one, the heart is a kite climbing on a long string of blood. Every cell in the body burns off the weight of too many years in the planet's shade. We've never been so light in our lives. Later we'll practice what to say in the bright world we'd given up for dead. For now, it is enough to know the wind is kicking up stiff in our favor, and the color coming back to our faces is real. I'd like to close with one last poem, a very new poem that is called Two for the Vegetable Man. Poem really comes from two different places in all the years that I've lived in the apartment where I do on Pershing, and I've heard the vegetable man clattering down the alley and thinking of W.C. Fields and It's a Gift, and vegetable man, and all the insidious plans he had. I've never once seen this vegetable man, though I've heard him. And the second thing got me thinking about this alley where I live, how in days it is still possible to be a festival alley, but by night the alley takes on a personality that is distinctly different, one this vegetable man is not here. It's a poem in two parts, two for the vegetable man, St. Louis, and tonight this poem is for the vegetable man who is an important figure that holds all this together for me. But tonight the poem is also for Barbara, who is the most important figure that holds all this together for me, too, for the vegetable man. I've never seen the vegetable man, but I know his litany and his bells as he negotiates the alley mornings when the sun's a bad idea coming up again. I've tried to sleep right through him, but I've heard his customers piling down fire escapes and waving their thick, thick hands. The woman up from Fayetteville whose robe is always undone. The fat black man who beats his dog when his check runs thin and none of his numbers comes up right. Dozens of my neighbors abandoning their beds and filling the alley with vegetable frenzy. They go down to marvel at the resiliency of lettuce, the humility of corn, the artichoke's high-mindedness. They can't see or hear me rooting around in my own dark garden of sleep. They're busy being lifted on the green wing of his song. It might be all right, his song and dance, if this were storybook Europe years ago, and I was staying with some kind family hiding me from the town constabulary. Maybe then I could take some comfort in his singing, could thank him underneath my breath for another day's auspicious sign. But there's always a price on local color this late in the century's season, where there's never enough sleep to undo the day before, and the cartoon dog who guards our sleep spins around and around on his leash. Here comes another day of fragile commerce in the world. We want infinite wisdom, and someone sells us potatoes. Unbelievably out of love, we settle for tumescence. I dream about tipping over his cart. I'm setting it on fire and I'm laughing while his produce rolls away free. He'll never know it could be worse, how every time I wake up colorless, hungry at noon, the day already picked over for the brightest plums, I think maybe tomorrow I'll leave my long bed and yell down for a pound or a sack of what everyone else is having. And he might turn his blank face up and wonder where the hell I've been all his life. For me, he's been saving the frivolous turnips, the cantaloupe's orange melancholy, the ineffable sadness in the onion's heart that's passed on inexplicably in silence. Here's to courage when the alley runs out and the vegetable man sings his long way home. That his children eat everything that threatens to go bad and they grow wiser. That the knife of his honest living steals itself in its sheath by his bed. That for him it continues to be this simple, paring things down to their essential gist, stalk and seed, pulp and core. It's a faith that could sustain us too, if only we could see it steaming from the soup, leaking from the colander, shining round and hard. And a woman is naked, crying in her window while the wrong song comes out of the radio. And someone we don't know is running, looking over his shoulder as far as he can back into his life and seeing it all in this single reflexive moment, this last dispatch from the heart going out. We need the man with his vegetable song, already dressing himself in the dark, to make it back another day and wake us with the only love he knows, so we can say over and over and mean it, like the edge of his knife means it's sure business, like his own children mean each morning they're alive. There's nothing in another night the color of bruise if it comes tonight. Can harm us. Thank you very much.